Call the next case, please.
Order versus Commonwealth, interview with an appellate counsel, Stephen A. Whitmer, senior assistant attorney general, appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I would like to reserve 15 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning, and I'm here representing Timothy Woodard, and what we're here on is one assignment of error, relatively simple issue. At the Court of Appeals, as you know, he was his conviction for felony murder was reversed and dismissed, and at the trial court, the trial judge, Judge Marlam and Gindel, had used the murder sentencing guidelines to come up with a sentence. The sentencing guidelines for a drug offense, if the drug offense was the primary offense, were radically different than the murder guidelines. The top of the drug guidelines was 3 years, 8 months. Bottom of the murder guidelines was 19 years, 3 months. Judge Milam imposed 14 years of active sentence at the hearing. With the reversal of the felony murder conviction, that took away 4 of those 2 years. So there remains at this time a 10-year active sentence for the 2 drug convictions, which my client is not contesting the convictions. He's asking for a resentencing. The issue of how have I asked for a resentencing, I think it's important for me to quickly walk through. As I pointed out in brief, I first asked for that in what I feel is the appropriate place, which was the relief sought in the petition for appeal. So that was before the Court of Appeals had even awarded an appeal, certainly before the Court of Appeals had ruled on the awarded petition. So as early as my petition for appeal, that was the relief sought. I've used the word contingent, a contingent request, because I think that is what it is. In a sense, I'm not saying, because I don't think I'm able to say, that the circuit court judge erred by not sentencing him on just the 2 drug convictions, because at the time there were 3 convictions. So at the time the issue was there sufficient evidence for the murder conviction? Judge Milam made his ruling on that, and then they proceeded to sentencing. And he sentenced him for 3 convictions. On appeal at the Court of Appeals reversed and dismissed the felony murder conviction. So my request, my relief sought, has been all along and remains simply asking for a resentencing hearing. I think that is fair. I think it's proper. As to whether the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction to rule on my request for a resentencing hearing, I maintain that the Court of Appeals did. The only place that was addressed was in footnotes, were in footnotes 1 and 5 in the March 26, 2013, published opinion by the Court of Appeals. And as I read it, I can't abundantly see whether the Court of Appeals was saying we don't have jurisdiction or we don't want to, or maybe they were saying both. So in my petition for rehearing and in my filings at this court, I've addressed both of those. In this court's Gamishlay, or however it's properly pronounced, in this court's case, when this court reversed the Court of Appeals in that case, this court said that the Court of Appeals does have jurisdiction as long as you have a timely filed notice of appeal, which identifies the convictions and the order which sentenced on those convictions, which I've done in everything I've filed. And as I've noted, even the orders entered by the Court of Appeals throughout the proceedings there used all 3 case numbers from Danville Circuit Court and the awarding of the petition for appeal, awarding of an appeal at the Court of Appeals incorporated all 3 circuit court case numbers. I think clearly and as a matter of law, the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction to rule on my request. I think clearly also the Court of Appeals had the opportunity to rule on it. It was placed in my relief sought in the petition for appeal and in my opening brief at the Court of Appeals. And the fact that the Court of Appeals ruled on it in 2 footnotes, that is in a sense, not in a sense, but it is actually an acknowledgement that I had made the request. So I I say the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction. I made the request. The Court of Appeals acknowledged that I made the request. The Court of Appeals said no. I think that leaves us with, was it reversible error for the Court of Appeals to say no? I think it cannot be harmless error. You've got a 10-year sentence with guidelines which would have been 1 year, 9 months, up to 3 years, 8 months, if it had been just the two drug convictions. And, as Judge Milam said at the sentencing hearing, at that time, he considered that Timothy Woodard was guilty of, legally responsible for, the death of the girl that took the ecstasy, and that's what he was, that was the basis of the felony murder conviction at the time. So when you take that out, I think the only fair thing, and that's why the Commonwealth should be afraid of a resentencing hearing. It I don't know if I've ever argued this in 25 years of appellate practice, but it just seems like the right thing to do. Let him have his resentencing hearing on the two remaining convictions. Let the circuit court judge consider those two convictions, those guidelines for the drug guidelines, and come up with an appropriate sentence. In the, I cited some case law, Lafler versus Cooper, the 2012 case from the U.S. Supreme Court, and the language in there about the proper exercise of discretion should be after an appellate court has changed the scenario. It should go back to the trial court level, and at that time, that's when the trial court should make its own determination. I'm not saying what the sentence should be. This court doesn't have to determine what the sentence should be, but there's quite a gap between 10 years and even the top of the guidelines. That's quite a gap. What the sentencing judge, whether it's Judge
Milam, the 10 years is within the statutory range.
Absolutely.
For the drug offenses.
Absolutely. Yes. Both. It was 2 years for the sale, and eight, as far as active, 2 years for the sale and 8 years for the possession with intent. And, of course, the sentencing guidelines refer to the conglomerate. When there is a range of the sentencing guidelines, it incorporates all three. It doesn't say, well, the range is 2 to 5 for that offense, 3 to 6 for that one. It's a conglomerate. So when you take away the primary offense, it changes the entire thing. In fact, in this situation, it would change not only the numbers, but it would change which guidelines you use. And this is, as Appellee's counsel brought up for the first time in the brief for the Commonwealth, 19.2, 298.01F, which says that improperly following the guidelines cannot be the basis for appellate reversal. I understand that. That's why I didn't raise it at the Court of Appeals, because that statute says that's not a direct appeal issue. But that does not mean that when you come to the relief sought as a contingent request that the court can consider, well, would this have been different? What reason might we have to think it would be different? And I think at that stage, which is where we're at, the Court of Appeals could have, and I think this court, de novo, can consider, well, there would be guidelines at the most. I mean, if you take out the murder, it's going to even be less than what it was of the 1-9 up to 3-8, because that was with the murder conviction, if you use the drug guidelines. That's with the murder conviction. So you take that out, it's going to be even lower than that. And I think the fair and appropriate thing is for this court to send it back down to circuit court, and then whatever Judge Milam chooses to do now, after having been had the situation changed materially, majorly, categorically, now come up with a sentence for the two drug convictions.
So what would the rule of this case be, that any time you have a conviction overturned and there would be a resentencing on the companion convictions and you have a different set of guidelines, is that what the rule of this case would be? Or would it be any time you have a conviction overturned, you send it back if you got companion cases?
I wouldn't mind that rule. I don't know that we have to, I don't know if this court would have to set forth that hard and fast rule. as in many cases, I think this court says we don't necessarily say that in every situation this is what it's going to be, but in this case we say that's what it's going to be. And I think what I'm asking is that this court hold that in this case, under these circumstances, and considering the factors of it would be a whole different guidelines, not just different numbers on the same guidelines, but it would be, for instance, if the drug convictions get reversed and you still had the murder conviction, well, that might be a little different because you still have the murder guidelines. Maybe a little less, but you'd still be on the murder guidelines. There's other factors in here in this situation of the note of remorse, and those are factors that can be considered, and they all would tend to mitigate punishment.
Would Judge Mollum sentence your client to begin with? Were the sentences that he imposed within the guidelines, the ranges?
They were. The overall sentence was within the murder sentencing guidelines. Well, I'm sorry, no, it was below the murder guidelines. As I said, the murder guidelines was 19 years, 11 months, up to 33 years, 3 months.
Okay.
So he went below what he said he went below. He said things on the record, and there's also the page, which unfortunately is not included in the appellate record, of the reason for departure, and the Circuit Court Clerk's Office did not send that up to the Court of Appeals or to this court. And all I'll say at this point, is just it's not in this record. Whether the court wants to hunt that down and get that, I have no objection to that, but it is not in the record. The Circuit Court did not send it to the Court of Appeals, and it's not before this court in the record. Because usually what happens, you get the sentencing, the pre-sentence report sent out to the court, and that's something that's written in, and apparently sometimes the clerk's office doesn't pick up on sending the additional handwritten reason for departure page along with the record. It is not in this court's record. I only have 3 minutes left.
All right.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Stephen Whitmer here on behalf of the Commonwealth today. In some ways, this case is about the importance of assignments of error. The appellant here today indicates that he's actually raising 2 separate claims. He's raising a claim that the Court of Appeals was wrong if it decided that it had no jurisdiction, and he's raising a claim that the Court of Appeals was wrong if it decided not to accept jurisdiction over a claim not raised by assignment of error. Those should have been 2 separate assignments of error in this court. The assignment of error that has been presented is not specific as required by this court's rules. That, of course, mirrors the situation that we had in the Court of Appeals below, where there was no assignment of error related to these other convictions or related to any need for resentencing on any offense.
Although they were part of the appeal, right?
I will acknowledge the notice of appeal included those, and had this... If this were an issue involving Rule 5A:6, it's very clear under Gamesh-Louis that the Court of Appeals had subject matter jurisdiction. There's no notice of appeal defect that would have deprived the Court of Appeals of subject matter jurisdiction under that holding. But it appears from the record that the Court of Appeals did not say we don't have jurisdiction. What the Court of Appeals said is this is not before us, and the Commonwealth submits that this case falls under the court's holding in Amin rather than under Gamesh-Louis, and the Court of Appeals simply has exercised its discretion to refuse to adjudicate a claim not presented by assignment of error. And this court has held that the Court of Appeals may do exactly that. Gamesh-Louis does not stand for the proposition that once an appeal is granted, the Court of Appeals must consider every issue placed before it, whether raised by assignment of error or not.
You suggest two assignments of error in your brief, neither of which appear to be the issue that is before us. As I'm reading the two assignments of error that you propose, appellant would have challenged the failure to apply the drug guidelines as opposed to the murder guidelines. I think those are the two that you suggest which would have got the issue before the court. But that's not their argument, as I understand it.
Well, that in fact does seem to be the argument. There was an argument raised at trial.
There was an argument raised at trial. Should use drug guidelines as opposed to murder guidelines. But the argument here seems different to me, and perhaps I'm wrong, but now that you've set aside the murder, the guidelines need to be rerun because they were run initially considering the murder.
And I'm suggesting that would be encompassed within the second exemplar assignment of error right that we provide on page 10 of the Commonwealth brief, which is the appellant could have said, assuming the evidence was insufficient to establish felony murder, the trial court erred in applying the sentencing guidelines applicable to murder instead of the sentencing guidelines for drug distribution in fixing the sentence. That would have placed the question before the Court of Appeals.
But, you know, that question is precluded by the statute that says the guidelines can't be the subject of an appeal.
I absolutely agree that it can't be a successful assignment of error. However, that's an assignment of error that would have been required to put the claim before the Court of Appeals. It can't be a successful assignment of error in the Court of Appeals, and it can't be a successful assignment of error in this court because the claim is statutorily precluded.
I'm not entirely sure that statute would preclude an appeal involving assignments of error the guidelines that are based upon clearly erroneous convictions. I think that somebody might have a due process claim that would allow an appeal despite 19.22.98.01. That statute, 298.01, talks about the discretion used, I think, with proper charges. I mean, I can't imagine that somebody couldn't appeal a case to this court if you're charged with, you know, larceny. And the judge says, well, I know you're charged with larceny, but I'm going to use the murder guideline. That would be a real stretch, don't you think?
Your Honor, I would tend to agree that that would seem superficially to be a stretch. However, our argument is that the statutory preclusion is exactly that strong.
Well, but I'm talking about a constitutional matter, not a statutory matter. Wouldn't somebody have a due process claim that would allow the constitutional provisions to trump the statute? We've never had one. I'm not sure we've never answered that question before. But I'm not sure that your interpretation is necessarily correct, but I also don't think it's important here.
The Court of Appeals has held that a defendant has no due process right to application of the sentencing guidelines at all, or the correct guidelines, or to any point on the guidelines above. I mean, this is, you know, the trial court can completely refuse to apply the guidelines.
Well, you don't need to deal with it here. I was just challenging the statement, and it's not really before us today, so you don't have to worry about it. What I'm concerned about in this case is that the appellant has a fairly good argument to make, but I'm not sure he actually got in the door of the court to make it.
Regardless of the merits of the argument, the Commonwealth's position in this matter is that he, while he may have gotten through the door in terms of subject matter jurisdiction, he did not request that the Court of Appeals exercise that subject matter jurisdiction by placing an assignment of error before them.
And there's no ends of justice exception that works to deal with your assignments of error. That deals with your contemporaneous objections.
That's correct, Your Honor.
See, that's what I think the problem is in the case.
That would present a difficulty in the appellant making the argument that he makes today, which is that this just doesn't seem fair. which is really the argument that's being presented. But the argument is, in the Commonwealth's view, precluded. Let me
assume for a second that he had what you would consider an appropriate assignment of error. What's your position on the merits?
Of the question of whether he can be resentenced?
Whether it should go back for remand for resentencing.
Our position is that it absolutely should not. There is the longstanding precedent of this court is that the appellate courts do not interfere with sentencing decisions of trial courts, provided they are within the statutory sentencing range. And so for that reason, as well as the statutory bar, our position would be that the defendant cannot prevail even if he properly got through the door.
Why wouldn't this be more akin to the line of cases where, and I understand the guidelines are the factor that makes this different from everything else, but why wouldn't the posture of this case be more akin to a situation where a jury in sentencing considers improper evidence? Case comes up, case gets, the decision is they were given, they considered improper evidence. It's sent back for resentencing. So in this case, you have a felony murder conviction that's been overturned. So arguably, the court considered improper evidence. Why wouldn't resentencing be the appropriate?
Your Honor, the trial court absolutely did not consider improper evidence. The evidence in this case clearly was that the action of the defendant in distributing drugs to the person who ingested the drugs was a proximate cause of her death. The Court of Appeals reversed for the failure to establish res gestae, closeness and connection in time and place between the act of distribution.
Okay, let me try another one. Revocation. You revoke someone for having been convicted of a crime. And I don't think we have a case, I couldn't find one. The Court of Appeals has a line of cases. Someone is revoked for having been convicted of a crime. Conviction is overturned. They have other issues for which they were revoked. Is sent back for resentencing because the crime that the convicted crime is no longer a factor. Why wouldn't that be the analysis?
Your Honor, in the cases that I am familiar with where there has been a simultaneous appeal of the criminal conviction and a probation revocation based on the conviction, there has been a need for a separate, prior to the change in the rules, question presented and now assignment of error, assigning error to the revocation, which in fact would go to the procedural difficulty the defendant has in raising this claim before the court.
Counsel, your statement that with regard, the correct statement with regard to the longstanding principle that an appellate court does not interfere with a trial court sentencing decisions, provided it's within the statutory range, intrigues me, because as I think about it, that argument actually cuts both ways in this case. In this case, the trial court sentenced based upon two convictions. If the appellate court says, we don't care whether the trial court would choose a different sentence, we're simply not going to give the trial court that opportunity, then the appellate court is interfering with the trial court's authority. Is it not?
I don't think it is. Justice Mims, there is no legal presumption that the punishment that was imposed for the two remaining offenses was not an appropriate punishment and the punishment that the trial court felt was necessary for those offenses.
The first half of that, I absolutely agree. It's appropriate because it's within the statutory range. It's appropriate by definition. But we have not heard from the trial court. When it goes back, the trial court could easily say, nope, I sentenced based upon the facts, and the facts are exactly the same as they were before. Or the trial court could say, I sentenced based upon the fact there were two convictions, and I will indeed reconsider now that there's only one conviction. neither you nor I know what the trial court's thought process would be.
And I would suggest that the trial court also, were it appropriate to remand, could say, well, now that the murder conviction has been overturned, there has not been any punishment imposed that reflects the aggravating factor of the death of this woman, and could increase the sentence.
There's no doubt.
And that would require us to speculate. There's no guarantee that a remand is favorable to the defendant or favorable to the Commonwealth.
The point is this. Based upon that longstanding theory, the decision is the decision of the trial court, not the Commonwealth and not the appellate courts.
And I would suggest to the court that the decision has been made. Now, there's appropriate as in the sense that within the sentencing guidelines, but the trial court also was required to fix a sentence that was appropriate to the defendant in light of this particular offense. And so the sentence is appropriate in that respect also. And for that reason, this does come within the scope of cases for which this court ordinarily would not reverse and remand for resentencing. If I may address, I think, two points. One, the issue of the defendant's culpability of death. The appellant suggests that the Court of Appeals has found him not culpable for the death. The Court of Appeals found that res justa was not proven. The Court of Appeals judgment leaves the culpability for death unadjudicated because the defendant could be reindicted for manslaughter, and such a prosecution would not be barred by Blockburger because the elements are different. So it is not the case that his responsibility for death has been absolved. Rather than discuss that other issue, I think I'll conclude by thanking the court for its time and attention and by asking that the court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Whedon?
Yes, just briefly, and I believe I did address this on brief, but 517C12, as far as the assignments of error, is worded a little differently than the rule of the Court of Appeals. In that, for this court, it's related to. It can include related to the action taken by the Court of Appeals, and I think that is intentionally broader. And I don't think that limits an assignment of error in this court necessarily to just the actual assignment of error at the Court of Appeals. It can be related to, and certainly this assignment of error that I've presented to this court is related to the actions of the Court of Appeals. And just what I presented, that they reversed the felony murder, and I made the request for the relief of a resentencing. They said no, so therefore my assignment to the Court of Appeals is what was related to their action. And as far as whether, when Justice Millett asked the question of whether a hard and fast rule should be applied, I thought of another distinction, and that is you could have cases where all three convictions were non-guidelines offenses. And in that situation, there would not have been guidelines. And therefore, if you took out one, perhaps that would be a situation where you wouldn't have a strong argument that the court might impose a different sentence without considering that additional conviction. But in this case, it's just the reality that it was based on the sentencing guidelines. It was within consideration of the sentencing guidelines. And
I've got a question for you, counsel. What standard do we use in determining, do you think we should use in determining whether the Court of Appeals erred in not remanding these cases? Is it they abused their discretion? As a matter of law, they were required to do so?
I have thought about that, and I feel that it was an abuse of discretion. I think that would be a sufficient standard to apply. I didn't find that either side directly addressed what standard this court would have to apply to the action of the Court of Appeals. I also think this court could rule de novo whether the Court of Appeals should have reversed and remanded the remaining two convictions for a resentencing. And so if there are no further questions, I thank the court for the court's time, and certainly on behalf of Mr. Wood.
All right, thank you, sir. Call the next case, please.